My name is David and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Ellen will read the preamble.
I'm an alcoholic and my name is Ellen. A preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help others to achieve sobriety.
Thanks, Ellen. Please join us in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Robin will read the steps.
Good evening. I'm Robin Taylor, and I'm an alcoholic. The steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thanks, Robin. Brian Anthony will read the traditions.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Brian Anthony, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Joe.
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's March 13th of 1985. This is my home group. My sponsor's name is Mel. And I'd like to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, hopefully in 10 minutes. I grew up in Texas. My parents came to Texas to a small town in South Texas to make their fortune in the shrimp business. And when I was 2 years old, my dad was coming home from work, and there was a car accident, and he was killed. And I have 2 other brothers and a sister. There were 4 of us. And so overnight, my family's world was turned upside down. And growing up, I had this feeling that somehow I was different from the other kids. They had fathers that would take them hunting and fishing, which is big back where I come from. And I didn't get to do any of that. And the big book, it talks about this feeling like something just isn't quite right. And the book describes it as a resentment. And it's when we perceive something to be unfair, even if we just perceive it to be unfair, whether it is or we're just perceiving it to be that way. And so I had this kind of vague sense of anger growing up. And when I was 13, my older brother and I went to Mexico. I grew up in a border town in South Texas. And I got drunk for the first time over there. I drank, and I remember the feeling. I remember how great it felt. And I remember, like, it's like I had discovered something that was kind of like a secret. Like, wow, this is great. You know, I just feel like this is just terrific. And I went back home that night, and I was sick at my stomach, and I woke up the next day with a hangover, and it deterred me for a while, but not for long. And in my junior year in high school, I went to Austin for the first time, Austin, Texas. And that's where the University of Texas is. And Austin is like was an awesome town. It was the first time I'd ever really been to a place like that where it was set up for, it was a college town, and there was tons of stuff to do. There were lots of clubs, and I joined a fraternity when I graduated from school, and I went to UT, and, that's really, really where I learned how to drink. And, it started this process of like drinking late at night and missing class in the morning, and, things went from kind of slowly went downhill. And I went, if you're new, you'll hear they'll talk about what they call a geographic, where you go back and forth. And I went back home, and I'd enroll in the community college there, and then I'd go back to UT in Austin. And when I was 21, I think it was 21, I was in my senior year, and just, you know, one more lap running around the track, and I would have had a degree from the finest school in all the Southwest. And I ran out of money. I'd spent what little money there was, and I was out most nights and drinking, and I had to leave school. went back home, and things went from bad to worse. And when I was 23, I was introduced to AA for the first time. And it wasn't really like something I was cherishing. You know, I kind of had my family on my back. And I came to AA, but I felt the energy here. I felt there was something about AA. I felt like there was a solution here. And it took me about a year to sober up. But I got sober in March of 85 when I was 24. And there were some things that I did, because I had been in and out during that year, but there were some things I did that changed it all. I was going to meetings. I kept going to meetings. And at one point, when I was going to two meetings a day, and I really immersed myself in the program and in the fellowship. I'd hang out, I'd go out for coffee with people after the meetings, and I'd hang out with them. I'd go over to people's houses and hang out with them. I heard a guy speak on a Wednesday night, and I looked him up in the phone book, and I called him. I instinctively knew that I needed to call this person, and he became my first sponsor, my first real sponsor. And he literally is the reason I'm here today. He passed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous on to me. And he became in a way, without us really ever talking about it, he kind of became a surrogate father. And so I've come to believe that, you know, if you're here tonight and you've been drinking and drinking's causing problems in your life, you know, God's going to meet you at your point of need. Whatever you're hurting over, you know, there's something here. The higher power is going to find a way to help you deal with that. And the reason I'm telling you all these things about what happened, I like a lot of people have some wreckage. I totaled a car in Houston into somebody's house. There's some things that I did that that alcoholics do. But when I look back at it now, I look back at those things, and that's what unmanageability was. Driving when I was drunk. I got these credit cards. They sent me credit cards, and I charged them up, and they cut me off. I did that drinking. This was back in college. And when I look back at how I'm powerless over alcohol and how my life is unmanageable, I look back at those things, and that's how I was unmanageable. The doctor's opinion says that what I suffer from is an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. And that when I take alcohol into my system in any form, it sets up a craving that's beyond human control. Lack of power is my dilemma. That I, by myself, can't keep me sober. But I need a power greater than myself, other than myself, to help keep me sober. And I found that power here in AA. I had about a year, and I was in a lot of pain, and I hadn't worked a fourth step. And I started writing out the fourth step, and I wrote down a list of all the resentments against all the people that I had. I wrote down a list of fears, and I wrote down a list of my selfish personal conduct. And I discussed it with my sponsor, and I did a fifth step with him. And in the book, it talks about a promise that the drink problem has been removed will come strongly. And I felt that. I felt like after I had done my fifth step, I felt like, you know, I've earned my seat here. And in all these 22 years that I've been coming around, you know, I've been pretty consistent in the meetings. I think it's maybe been a month in the late 80s when I missed going to meetings for about a month or so. But, if you're new, meetings are important. This is where the solution is. You come to AA. They said when I was new, bring the body and the mind will follow. Bring the body and the mind will follow. And you sit in the chair and try to figure out what's this all about. And it took me about a year to really figure out what it was really all about. When you're at the meeting, listen for somebody that you can connect with, somebody that you feel like you can talk to and that you trust, and sound that person out. Ideally, this person will become a sponsor. It's a person that will help you work through the steps. And the steps are the program of recovery. The steps are how a person goes. It's how I went from drinking to not drinking. So I'm grateful. I want to thank Chris for asking me to speak, and I'm grateful to the people who are instrumental in this meeting, and it's really good to be here. I'm It's an awesome group. I love this group. Great group of people. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Caitlin.
Hi, my name is Caitlin, and I'm an alcoholic. Woo! What a privilege to speak at my home group. I'm really nervous, but I know that that's going to pass really soon. My grand sponsor says that that's God shaking the truth out of me. So, so hopefully, you know, I can be as truthful as I can. Okay, so my sobriety date is January 28, 2005. My sponsor is Patty. I'm currently working on step 9 and practicing 10, 11, and 12. And my home group is Atlantic Group. So I'm going to just start, you know, with a little bit of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me now. I grew up in Park Slope, Brooklyn. My parents were in the wrong marriage, so it was very it was very chaotic. You know, my mom was pretty much always angry, and my dad drank a lot. And you know, it was pretty normal. My father's family, you know, it was pretty normal to drink. I grew up surrounded by alcohol, and you know, all of it was pretty normal to me. I thought that, you know, having a drink at, you know, 12 o'clock in the afternoon was normal. Drinks at dinner were normal. And it wasn't until I kind of ventured outside to other people's houses that I realized that that really wasn't a normal thing. But I do believe that no matter what kind of environment I grew up in, I would have still been an alcoholic. What I really like to focus on is that I feel like my first emotions that I can identify with growing up were fear. I was constantly afraid of losing people I loved, of dying, and, you know, which is not very normal for a child to think about those things. I did feel very separate and apart from my fellows. And, you know, I was constantly living in my head. I remember sitting up at night thinking a lot about, you know, something that would happen that day and, you know, just being consumed by my thoughts, really. And, you know, when I had my first drink at 14, you know, I was hanging out with two of my friends, and it was actually a 40 of Old English and malt liquor. And I finished it, and, like, everything went into autofocus. The world got brighter, and most importantly, like, I forgot everything that I was afraid of, and I felt exactly like all of you looked on the outside, on the inside. And I wanted to do it all the time after that. So throughout high school, I pretty much, you know, lived for the weekends. I would, you know, write, like, listen to some depressing music, isolate, write poetry during the week, and then I would party on the weekends. And that's when I thought that, like, all of it happened. Like, that's when my connections happened with people. And, you know, that's pretty much true throughout my whole story. When I was 19, I thought that, you know, New York City was the problem with my life, and I moved to a ski resort in Colorado. And I did the whole ski bum thing, and it was awesome because I was 19. I had no parents to tell me what to do, and I was able to drink all the time. And that was pretty much when I started seeing my alcoholism come out. I would stop. I would not show up for jobs, not show up for people that I loved. I would do things that I said I would never do, and so on and so forth. And I woke up with these really horrible feelings of guilt and remorse and, you know, complete self-pity. And I was just consumed in selfishness, which I now learn is the root of all my problems. So it was, you know, I came home from Colorado. I thought that the town was too small and, you know, move back. And I, you know, continued to do everything that I did there here, and it just got worse. You know, the people got shadier. I lost every single real friend that I had. So even though I had a lot of friends, I was completely alone. And I just dreaded going home at the end of the night, because I would be lying there in my bed alone with myself and my thoughts and my misery. And so I would basically stay out until I couldn't, you know, drink or do anything anymore. And, you know, I just remember writing contracts to myself and, you know, waking up the next day and being like, this is horrible. I'll never do this again. I need to stop. And I would sign them, and, you know, the next day I'd be out doing it all over again. And, you know, that's just insanity. And you know, I always thought that I could do it differently. And I never could. And I was a complete disappointment to myself and everyone around me. My last night of drinking was pretty much the same as every other night. I went out. I missed the first day of classes. But for some reason, something happened where I just, you know, whether it was divine intervention or not, I reached out to my mother, and I couldn't, you know, confrontation's not really for me, so I wrote her an email, and I said, you know, I'm really scared, you know, either I'm gonna kill myself or, you know, someone's gonna kill me, and I don't know how to stop. And you know, she came home later that day, and she wanted to talk about this. And of course, like, once I felt better, I was like, oh no, no, like, I'm fine. Like, I don't even know what that was, you know? And she said, no, really, you need to go to an AA meeting. And you know, I have uncles in the program, so my family is very familiar, with AA. And she said, you have to go to a meeting, and or else I'm kicking you out. And at that point, like, that was enough motivation for me to go, because I really had nowhere else to go. And so I said, okay, one meeting and that's it. And she was like, yes. And we had a family friend, and he picked me up with his friend and in his car, and we drove to his friend's house, and they sat me down on the couch, and they made me tea, and they said, we're just going to read from the big book, and you just listen. And I said, okay. And I don't remember what part that they read, but I felt so at home. And I felt so comfortable, and just happy that, you know, I finally knew what was wrong with me. And I'd like to say that I came in and, you know, I did everything perfectly, but I didn't. And you know, I was pretty much, you know, I took a while to get a sponsor. I didn't really go to meetings that much. You know, I kind of glazed through the steps. I got to 4, and I was like, I don't need to do this. Because I really thought that alcohol was my problem. And I thought that if I just gave that up, then I would get better. And you know, in my 7th month of sobriety, I was in so much pain that, I had nothing to do but throw myself more into this program. You know, I was so afraid of my bottom that I didn't drink, but I could have. And I didn't want to kill myself, so I was like, all right, this is what I have to do. And I called my friend, who, like, was really happy, you know, and she came to this meeting. And you know, I was like, oh, my sponsor said, call this girl, you know. And I was like, do I have to call her? Like, she's so happy. And you know, she took me to Thursday night, and you know, people stand up around the room and say what step they're on, and, you know, their sponsor and their home group. And anyway, it really motivated me to get busy. And I got a sponsor. My sponsor's name is Patty. And you know, she took me through the steps. And you know, it's really amazing. Sobriety is, for me, doing things like that make me feel uncomfortable and doing them anyway. You know, like walking through the fear and realizing that life really isn't that hard. And, you know, I sponsor two amazing women today, and I have an amazing sponsor. I do a lot of service, and, you know, I feel like my life is beyond my wildest dreams just because I don't wake up every day feeling miserable. You know, I really am the person that I drank to be today. And I just, you know, I feel so comfortable with myself. And, you know, at any point in my day, when I'm feeling those old feelings of fear, and insecurity, I have a higher power in my life today that, I can turn to. And, it's really amazing. So if you're new, stick around, get busy, because you can, you know, spare yourself a lot of misery, and you know, you're at home here, so thank you very much.
CDs of tonight's meeting can be purchased from Taylor and Phil at the audio table in next week's meeting. Additionally, A speaker tapes may be borrowed from the lending library. As was said, this meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see remain here. If you are speaking at another group and with some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. And our main speaker tonight is Dayton.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Dayton. And my sobriety date is April 9th, 1990. That's my first sobriety date and hopefully my last. My home group is the Atlantic Group. I've had a service commitment at this meeting since 1994. My sponsor's name is John Forbes. I spoke to him today, and I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12. And, you know, I'm glad that we say, many people at the Atlantic Group, we have the tradition of saying that before we speak, because I believe that it's important to be active in AA. And my story is I've always been active. There's never been a time where my sponsors had to say to me, you should get more active in what you're doing. And, you know, I hope that continues to be my story, because I'm one of those people, I'm a great starter. At the beginning of the semester, I get the books, I read them, but by the end, it's like, you know, the Cliff Notes or whatever. And so often I've seen people come into AA and we do the work and our lives get better because God enters the lives. And then, you know, I've seen so many times people, they drift away. And a lot of times you hear in meetings, and this is my own opinion, that the most important person is the newcomer. I really believe that the most important person is the person between like 5 and 15 years, because those are the people who are like just, they've done the work and they're showing up to help others. And they're the ones that are here in the room helping the new people. And, you know, in Bill's story, it talks about how he had a conscious contact with God, and then it was blotted out shortly thereafter because of worldly clamors, most of them within himself. And that's what happens to us. We get the spiritual connection, and then one of the first things to go would be AA and the thing that has given us our life back. Both of my parents are alcoholics, and fortunately, they both got sober before they died, because most alcoholics go to the grave believing that their level of drinking doesn't rise to what they feel an alcoholic should be. And with my dad, he was kind of brought into the room. So he had esophageal varices, which means that his liver shut down. He was in his early 50s, and it caused his esophagus to rupture. And there's a story in the big book about it. And basically, with that condition, if you drink again, you're almost guaranteed to die. And he didn't drink again, but he died 16 years after he had his last drink of cirrhosis of the liver, because his liver never regenerated itself. And I got sober a lot younger than he did. And, you know, that's kind of the face of the thing to come, that, you know, the death of, that this is a fatal disease that we're dealing with. Growing up in an alcoholic family, my parents had this obsession with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really didn't know what AA was. But we'd be like driving down the road and they'd see like an Easy Does It bumper sticker, and they like speed past the person to see what the alcoholic looked like. I mean, they're just raging alcoholics. And then we would go out for dinner and they'd, you know, be drinking, and, you know, this back in the 60s and 70s, I guess you'd get drunk and throw the kids in the car. It probably still happens today with alcoholics, but. And on the way home, there was a meeting of AA on Race Road, and they would, like, drive through the parking lot of the AA meeting to see, you know, what kind of cars these people were driving. And so, but again, I didn't know what AA was, and I just, in my mind, I assumed that Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that AA was a place where people went, alcoholics that couldn't drink in public, that their drinking was so out of control that they had to, like, drink at this church where I went to kindergarten. And so when I was about 9 or 10 years old, I was in summer camp, and we had a skit that I wrote, basically. And I played the town drunk, and I, like, rolled in. I had, like, a soda bottle that was in a brown paper bag, and I was acting drunk as, you know, I didn't have to act as I got older, but I rolled in and onto the stage, and I'm like, I'm the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I just thought that's how it went, so. Anyways, but that's, if you're new, we don't drink here. Tonight, I decided that I'm going to tell the vomit stories, and I haven't told these since 2000. It's been 7 years. People are drowning, and I'll probably have 25 years of sobriety by the time I tell them again, but I guess they just need to be told tonight. One night, I was in a restaurant, and I had been drinking quite a bit, and you know, sometimes you get that feeling, you know, ahead of time that you're going to throw up. But I was at the table, and I didn't have time to go anyplace, so I, like, stood up, I sat down, I started to take my money out, my friends were looking at me like, what's going on here, and the pressure is building and building and building, and I put my hand over my mouth, and the velocity was so great that it hit the table next to us, and I'm a blackout drinker, and I wasn't blacking out at this time. Like, I remember just the look on their face, and, you know, that was really embarrassing. Another time, I was in a guy's room, and we were playing a drinking game, and I knew that I was going to vomit, and so I just, like, opened up my shirt and, like, threw up in the shirt. and then I forgot about it, and I, like, went downtown. And that night, I actually had a caricature done of myself, and it was of me, like, standing upside down drinking, and I had a bow tie. I wear bow ties so that when I drink upside down, the tie doesn't plop into my face. And it's still on my mom's house. And what I can't figure out is I wasn't wearing a bow tie that night. But I look at the picture, and I'm like, I had vomit down my shirt when the guy made that character. Sure. On my 22nd birthday, I was drinking 22 shots, one shot for each year, plus my usual drinking. And a friend of mine gave me a double shot of 151, and I was speaking to this young lady. I took the shot. She had no chance to get out of the way. I just vomited right on her. When I was in law school, I had a girlfriend who, this just a very sweet girl from South Carolina. She went to Sweeper Iron. I would bring her back. I lived in this house, like, beautiful, on a creek with a grassy valley, and I would go out into the field with a bottle of vodka and make her stand and watch while I would, like, drink, and then I would, like, arc, and I thought it was, like, a form of art with, like, how the moon would, like, show the fluorescence of the alcohol coming out of my esophagus. I don't know, but she started going to Al-Anon, and my reaction to that wasn't that, no, I'm not an alcoholic. My reaction was, well, I don't know why you're going to Al-Anon. We really don't have much of a relationship, and which is a cruel thing, and that was a tough amends to make. And, you know, speaking of Al-Anon, Al-Anon is a very important program, and if there's anyone in this room that has some stretch of sobriety that hasn't been to Al-Anon, it might be worthwhile to check it out. Of course, that's unsolicited advice that they tell you not to do in Al-Anon, but I found that it's been beneficial when I've gone there. If you just look around at the people that we hang around with, I mean, it's all alcoholics, so there's definitely something to be learned there. One time I threw up in a refrigerator, and when I did that, I was in a blackout, and I didn't really believe that I'd thrown up in a refrigerator because it just doesn't make any sense, and lo and behold, I went over to the guy's house the next day, and he was there cleaning the food out of the refrigerator. And I guess I just thought that at the time it makes sense to throw up in a refrigerator. you know, what does that have to do with alcoholism? Not really a lot of anything. I'm sure there are non-alcoholics that vomit when they drink too much alcohol. I think what separates me from those other people, though, is after every one of those times, the ones that I can remember that I wasn't on a blackout, I continue drinking. Because I don't drink to get drunk. I drink to satisfy a craving. If it was just a matter of getting drunk, I would get drunk and I would stop and go on. But I get beyond drunk. The big book talks about how the real alcoholic is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's usually more or less insanely drunk. And like, you know, mildly intoxicated, that's, you know, sounds attractive to me. I'm intoxicated, but I'm mild or insanely drunk. I'm insanely drunk and I get visibly intoxicated. The other night I was coming home from a meeting and there was a guy who was visibly intoxicated. It was early, but he was visibly intoxicated. And I saw him going up to his apartment and I hate to admit this, but I'm like, I want to see this because the key going into the door. You know, I don't know why that's such an easy thing to do, but when you're very drunk, you know, sometimes you can't even get in. But, I saw him, he's like steadying himself and he got the key and I'm like, right on. You know, happy flying Red Baron, but, I get visibly intoxicated and, you know, about the vomiting, sometimes I would vomit in my sleep and I would sleep on my back a lot of the time because I would get the bed spins, and to get rid of the bed spins, you put a foot on the floor and a hand on the wall or the headboard and it works. It stops the spins, but people die that way. And, you know, that's the scary thing about alcoholism is that we're not afraid to die. You know, it says in the book that to live a spiritual life or to be doomed an alcoholic death are not always easy alternatives to face. And we actually, we read that and it makes sense to us. I mean, alcoholic death, spiritual life. And we think about it. And you know what happens? And what happens with the alcoholic death is we just see the alcohol. We leave out the death part. But, and you know, we laugh. It kind of sounds funny from the podium. But people die from this disease. And, you know, in the short amount of time that I've been sober, you know, I've known a number of people who have died. Chance, Deidre, Reed, Scott, Nockham, Brad. That's a half dozen. I know a lot more than that. And that's because, you know, we're not afraid to die. When we think about alcohol, we don't think about the death part. And, you know, what we're dealing here with is that insane thought that precedes the first drink. That's all this is all about. You know, we come to meetings, we do service, our lives get better. But when you strip everything away from it, basically what we're dealing with is that thought that precedes the first drink that tells us for some reason this is going to be different. And the big book talks about sometimes there can be a certain mental blank spot where we don't think at all. Usually we're thinking before we pick up a drink. And I have, it's not a habit, when someone comes back and I know them, I often really press them about what is it that you were actually thinking when you picked up the drink. And they'll say, well, you know, that I broke up with my girlfriend and this, but I'm like, what was going through your head when you walked into the liquor store? And more often than not, people will not admit exactly what it is, what they're thinking. And I believe that when Bill Wilson wrote the big book and he talked about the insanity of alcoholism, that twisted mental thought, I think he used artistic license because we don't like to admit how insane the thought is. And so basically, when I got to AA, I learned that there was nothing that could be done about the physical craving that I have for alcohol. My problem is centered in the mind. And I've got to get into a state so that when I get to that point where taking a drink makes sense. And despite all the things that I told you at the outset that I do, there are times that drinking makes sense to me. And that's a scary thing because I'm right in the middle of AA and I haven't acted on it, but I think to myself, What would have happened if I'd let up on AA's program? Would I buy into these lies? And, you know, the big book in the 10-step promises, it doesn't say that we're never tempted by alcohol. It says that we're seldom tempted by alcohol. Because the problem is that in my case, and I think for most of us, alcohol worked. You know, alcohol in some respects is a cure for alcoholism because what alcohol does is it quiets the mind. You know, all that clutter that we have that we call the spiritual illness, alcohol very quickly if I'm having a bad day or a good day, alcohol just takes care of everything. The problem is, though, is that alcohol has really bad side effects because I have a physical craving for it. And if I pick it up, the physical craving is going to kick in. I'm going to get thrown back into that cycle of spring remorse. So basically, when I got to AA, I learned that if I'm not working the steps, I'm just wrestling between drinks. And, you know, I was fortunate that I had a sponsor who got me into the work right away. Back then, it was the early 90s, and we did a lot of work out of the 12 and 12. Now everything's out of the big book, which I think is great, because the 12 and 12 is a great piece of literature. I've been using it a lot recently. But the big book gives us exact instructions. What the 12 steps are basically are assembly line spirituality. That, you know, if we start as a hopeless alcoholic at step one and we take these steps, we're guaranteed to have a spiritual awakening and a connection with God. And that's what it's all about. The disease centers in the mind. And it says in the third step that, isn't he a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness from life if he only manages well? And that's my problem, that, you know, I tend to take God out of the equation. It says in the third step that we've got to voice the prayer without reservation. I don't say it all the time without reservation. I want to keep my will in the back pocket, you know. You know, keep $100 in my back pocket just in case. I kind of want to sort of turn my will over. And what the book is telling us is that we've got to get in line with what God's will is for us. And so I go about my day, and I'm all in my head, and I think I know what's going to make me happy. And, you know, that's one of the problems that we have, is we think we know what's going to make us happy. And, you know, if I were to sit down with you and tell you what I think it is that I need in life to make me happy, you'd laugh. And if Peggy were to do the same, I say, no, Peggy, you don't need that. You don't see what's going on here. Thanks. As a lot of you know, I'm a big fan of live music, and there's a band that I follow around almost obsessively. When Allie married me, she thought, like, maybe he'll outgrow it. But, you know, I go to these concerts with kids half my age. They're all dreaded out and spun out, and I can guarantee you that 99% of the people in this room, if you went, you wouldn't have a good time. You'd be like, get me out of here. But I happen to like it. And so one of the bands that I'm interested in now, they were playing a show out in Vail, Colorado, back in March. And, you know, I was fortunate that God gave me the resources that I could go, and I went out, I did some skiing, I saw some music that I liked, I saw some friends that I'm close with. And, you know, that's all well and fine, but that's all the material. You know, that really, if anything came out of that, the spiritual would be the new friends that I made, and I actually stayed with a person out there who I had reconnected with that I hadn't been in touch with for a long time, and that was great. But fast forward to a few weeks after that, I'm in the sauna at my club, and there are two guys talking about Vail, Colorado. And from listening to their conversation, I realized that I was out there the same weekend that they were talking about. So I'm reading my paper. I'm not even involved in this conversation, but I'm starting to feel good about myself. You know, for what? You know, but just because I was there. And the conversation progresses, and then one of them says to the other, can your jet make it to Vail without refueling? All of a sudden, I'm not feeling good about myself. And the guy responded, he said, it all depends on the headwinds, you know? So, but the thing is, all of a sudden, my mind's going, I don't have a jet. Chances are, I'll never have a jet. And it just goes on and on. But the thing is, I wasn't even part of that conversation, but this is what's going on in my head. And I actually walked out of there. I felt pretty good. I said, you know something? I never have to worry about the headwinds when I go to the airport. I'm sure that the guy with the jet, you know, is his assistant. Like, how are the headwinds looking for my Friday? But you know, what does that have to do with alcoholism? It has a lot to do with alcoholism. Because you hear in AA, especially at a lot of beginners meetings, people say, feelings aren't facts. And they just kind of, it's like a throwaway line, like we shouldn't be concerned about the feelings. And you know something? The feelings are what this is all about. I'm never going to drink over the facts. I'm only going to drink over the feelings. You know, I'm not going to drink over the fact that I don't have a jet. I'm going to drink over the fact because I'm afraid that I'll never have a jet, or if I had a jet, then I'm going to lose it. And, it, you know, it says on the... It says in the 12 and 12, in the seventh step, that self-centered fear is the chief activator of our character defects. And so we've got to be free of the fear, and we've got to learn that the feelings are what it's going to drive us to drink. And there is a big difference between an emotion and a feeling. Everyone gets emotions except for people who are sociopaths. There's nothing wrong with emotions. There are good emotions and bad emotions. But what happens is, with me, I get an emotion and it triggers the storylines in my head. All of a sudden, I'm like running the permutations and I'm running the movies and I'm going to say this and they're going to say that. And that, you know, that's what we're talking about, the spiritual disease. Those storylines in our head on top of the emotions. And basically what we have to learn is we have to learn how to quiet the mind and how to observe the mind and realize that we're separate from what's going on in here. And, you know, that's the third step, basically says, you know, but doesn't basically say, it definitely says that we had a new employer being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. And what that means is that right now at this very moment, God is taking care of me. You know, God is going to take care of me in the future, but I can't get tied up in the future. The only time I can have that contact is right now. And if I'm not having the contact, if I have a lot of fear, anger, and worry going on, I've got to ask myself, what is it inside of me? What is the poison? What is the character defect? That if I ask God to remove it, I could be happy and I could relate to my fellow man. And, you know, everything with me is self-centered. You know, I'm not lying awake at night thinking about Joel's problems. I'm thinking about my problems. And the thing is, God is going to take care of us, and we're always going to have problems. You know, we think that we're going to all of a sudden have this spiritual epiphany once we get over our problems, but the problems are going to be there. But what AA teaches us is how to react to our problems. And I said this when I spoke a few years ago, and I'm going to repeat it. I don't like to repeat myself too much, but sometimes, you know, my story is my story. But one of the most important things, the most important thing for everyone in this room right now is to get oxygen. If we don't get oxygen, you know, within 5 or 6 minutes, we're done. And the whole process, this is going to sound a bit esoteric, but just stick with me on it. When you think about how we get the oxygen, you know, we breathe in oxygen, breathe out the carbon dioxide. Then the green plants and the algae and all that, they take the carbon monoxide and they produce oxygen. And, you know, of course, there's got to be a power greater than myself that can do that. I can't do that on my own. And it happens without any effort or thought on our part, but it's the most important thing going for us. I don't sit home at night thinking, you know, I got to get out there and water the plants because I'm afraid that I'm not going to get an oxygen, or I'm not calling my sponsor saying, you know, John, I'm afraid that I'm not going to get enough oxygen tomorrow. This photosynthesis thing, could you explain it to me better? We don't do that because, you know why? We trust that the oxygen is going to be there. And the reason I make the point is that's how God wants us to be with respect to all of our life. God doesn't want us to worry about things. God wants us to take the action. And just like we don't worry about getting enough oxygen, God doesn't want us to worry about, you know, where the next paycheck is coming from or whatever. God is going to take care of all of that. But what we got to do is we've got to align ourselves with God's will, and we've got to act like God's kids. You know, if I am one of God's kids, I got to act like one of God's kids. And I've got to realize in the process that there are a lot of people in this world that don't act like God's kids, but that doesn't give me license not to act in a spiritual manner. Sometimes in AA, we talk like we have a monopoly on the spiritual illness, and we don't. Everyone is spiritually ill to one extent or another. The difference between us and them is our knee-jerk reaction to our spiritual illness. Our solution is alcohol. Other people, it may be something else, and we can't really get caught up in what that is. But we've got to learn how to be at peace with ourselves and to accept that God is taking care of us. And as a lot of you know in this room, you know, Allie and I have been going through a tough time. She was diagnosed with cancer 10 years ago, and it hasn't really gone into remission ever. And, you know, the past about 8 or 9 months has really, you know, been beating up on her and, you know, beating up on me because I'm part of it as well. And, you know, it's amazing. God is taking care of us there too. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. We just show up. She gets the medicine. But what's amazing is how AA shows up for us. And, you know, I've seen it so many times in AA, you know, the people, you know, that call to check how she's doing, offer to take her to a meeting, offer to get something at the grocery store. You know, that's what we do around here is we show up for each other. And it really is beautiful because that doesn't happen every place else. Every place else, people are really caught up in self. And what we learn here is that, you know, both the third step and the seventh step prayers, it doesn't say do these things so I feel better. It says do this so that I can be helpful to others. And what we learn is to get, you know, Van always used to say, get out of self, help others. And the dirty secret to that is we know that by getting out of self and helping others, we're going to feel better in the long run. And, you know, Van always used to say that, you know, this isn't a selfish program. It's a selfless program. And another thing he used to say that I loved is that we'll learn to love you until you can love others. Because that's really, you know, I love myself plenty. That's never a problem, you know. My worst character defect is self-indulgence. And, you know, I'm afraid that if I lose the self-indulgence, the flip side of it is going to be self-denial, which that's never going to happen. I'm always going to take care of myself. And what I've got to do is I've got to get out of myself, and I've got to ask God to have that character defect removed, because God will always remove a character defect if we're willing to have it removed. And there's schools of debate, you know, whether you should go back through the steps or not, or just use 10, 11, or 12. But I think that steps 6 and 7, and this is my own opinion, are crucial steps, because that's where we change, and that's where we continue to change. And we really can't change on our own. We need to ask God's help, because God is what makes change possible. And, you know, you hear a lot of times people, you know, you drink over 4 and 5. People don't really drink over 4 and 5. People drink over 6 and 7 because we're not changing. But once we get time, we got to realize that we got to continue to go back. You know, we've had successes with 6 and 7. We see that God can remove the defects. I've got to go back to it. And it's like kind of like the old V8 commercial. You know, why I could have had a V8. I'll act on a character defect and then afterwards think, you know, I could have worked 6 and 7 on that. I'm a big believer in FIS, fun and sobriety. And, you know, there were a couple of people in here that had less than 10 days. To give up alcohol is such a big thing for us to do. I mean, that's what kept me away from AA so long, because I knew that I was an alcoholic, but what we know the cure to be is a bit, and it's not even the cure, is drastic stopping alcohol, because alcohol is what provided me with relief. And how I got here, actually, is I had basically run out of drink tickets. The house of cards was about to fall, but I didn't want to give up drinking, because I love to drink. And a situation arose where I ended up in my parents' house outside of Boston. They were away, and my car had been confiscated by the police, which is kind of the unmanageability. And so I was I never really tell this, I don't know why I'm telling it now, but I was on the couch drinking a six pack. I actually had a cooler because I didn't want to keep going back and forth to the refrigerator. And I was reading my mom's AA literature, because inquiring minds wanted to know, what do people in AA do when they stop drinking? Because I couldn't envision a life without alcohol. And I had 44 questions. It was my mom's AA pamphlet. I'm reading through it, thinking, well, they've got to answer it here somewhere. And essentially they asked that question, you know, what do alcoholics do when they stop drinking? And to paraphrase it, it says, this really isn't any consequence to us, because we found that by and large, once we stop drinking is when we really started living. And that's when I made my decision to come into AA. And my story is, I waited like 6 or 7 weeks. I made the decision and I kept drinking, and another time when I have more time, I'll get into that story. But the big book says we absolutely insist on the enjoyment of life. When Allie goes to see her oncologist, the oncologist isn't saying we absolutely insist on enjoying life. You know, we have a fatal disease and we're given that promise. But like anything else, as I started out at the outset, you know, the worldly clamors come in and blots out our conception of God, and we move away. And that's why we have to stay vigilant, and we can't rest on the Lord, because we just have a daily reprieve, and it's contingent upon our spiritual maintenance of our spiritual condition. In closing, I always close with this prayer. About 5 years ago, we went to see a spiritual healer upstate. And I think he really helped, because that's when Allie had a pretty dire diagnosis. And that was actually, was now that I think about it, was 8 years ago. And, you know, it's 8 years later and she's doing pretty good, all things considered. But he gave a prayer that I think sums up spirituality as best I know, that says, "God, I don't understand you, but I trust you."